Welcome to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, where we explore the leadership journeys facing life science entrepreneurs. I'm David Kirk, and in each episode, I sit down with a life science leader to uncover the moments that define their leadership. My guest this week.
Hi, David. Nice to see you. Lisa Deschamps. I am the CEO of a company called Aviato Bio. We are a CNS gene therapy company based out of London and globally focused.
We're grateful at LifeScience.org to have a community of over 400 life science CEOs, leaders driving change in biotech, medtech, tech bio, and healthcare. The conversations inside our community, stories of conviction, navigating challenges, and making bold decisions inspire us every week. Now we're sharing them with the world.
Lisa, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
You have an amazing career. You started with a business background. You moved into Novartis. You were there for, 25 years? Is that right?
Yes.
And you moved up to SVP, Chief Business Officer with Novartis Gene Therapies before becoming CEO of Aviato. Tell me, how did you get into life sciences in the first place?
A great question. And I have a very non-traditional answer. So, and for those of you that have heard me speak before, I apologize if this is a repeat, but I actually came into life sciences by accident. So I was, as you say, a business major focused in marketing and very much with a passion for fashion. So I started my career in fashion. And I had a family friend who was in healthcare and had always tried to encourage me to go into it. And so I kind of went on the interview only to appease my mother, who had been encouraging me to do so for quite a long time, and just kind of showed up. And anyway, here I am 30 years later, and, truly can't think of a better career journey that I've had. So I'm very grateful for my mother and for my exposure early on to an industry that really makes a tremendous difference in people's lives. But it's definitely a little bit of a non-traditional path.
What was it that spoke to you about healthcare that made you step away from that passion?
So, yeah, I'm very, very fortunate to have the first person I interviewed with was extremely just passionate about the work that the company, it was Sandoz at the time, it was prior to even the merger between Sandoz and Ciba Geigy, which then became Novartis. And, you know, just understanding or really taking a moment, I had never really thought about it. I hated science in school, so I was not a science geek, so please don't share that too broadly. Anyway, I never really thought about how science translates into life-changing medicines for people and truly makes a difference. And so sitting down and actually having, you know, taking a moment, having a conversation with somebody, Gus Lolis was his name, who's still a friend today, and hearing about the difference that we could make, as well as the entrepreneurial aspects. I started in sales and you kind of manage your own little business and your customers. And the combination of those two things sounds piqued my interest enough to go on the second interview and the third. And then, as I say, here I am, 30 years later. And it's been an amazing journey to be able to see in real time the difference that we can have on people's lives. I really underestimated how fulfilling that could be. And I'm very much excited to and humbled to be a part of that journey.
Wow. That's amazing how one little conversation just kind of possibly changed the trajectory of your whole,
yes,
your whole life, and possibly the lives of many other people, given that the projects you've overseen in your time.
Yeah. I remember when I received the binders, December 15th, 1995, I received about 8 binders of anatomy and physiology. And I thought, oh no, what did I do? Anyway, I still persevere.
And you mentioned there, I like this appeal of having your own little business almost within it. Because you've held various leadership positions throughout your career within Novartis before becoming a CEO, when did that spark of inspiration come to become a leader?
I would often, and you as a scientist, I'm sure, think about this a lot too, the debate, the longstanding debate about nature versus nurture as it relates to leadership. And I wish I could say that there was one pivotal moment in my life. I think I was born around that, right? So, you know, my father was a serial entrepreneur and always exposed me at a very early age. And so I was, you know, at 8 years old, going on business trips with him, presenting to in boardrooms, and watched him, you know, in real time, build companies, lead teams, and just was so exposed to that. And so throughout my childhood, I had that, the luxury of that exposure and the encouragement to step up and lead. My grandmother, the matriarch of our family, was very much always like, you don't wait for people to, you know, help you or solve your problems. You get up and you lead the way and you solve them for everybody else. And so there was just, it was just a, again, I think a combination of nature and then the nurture around what's expected of each of us as people. And so, you know, early on in my childhood, I had that exposure as well as those opportunities in high school. I was, you know, student council president. I led a number of youth organizations in the community. And I just kind of then graduated to do that, you know, as I went on into business environments. But it never really was an option. It was an expectation, I would say, in at least in my family.
Was it? Because I love that background. You don't hear people growing up with that as normality very often. Yeah. Was it pressure, or was it really just, this is natural?
It wasn't even a thought, actually. It was just the way it was. You know, again, back to my grandmother, she never even thought to complain or whine or say something was unfair. It just expected of you. If you didn't like something, then you were expected to change it and step up and lead that. And so I hadn't really even thought about it. I didn't feel it as a pressure. I just felt it as that's the way things are meant to be. And so that's the way it was. You know, if I reflect on my career, were things harder at times as a female to progress and get to certain levels? Sure. I mean, yes. But it goes back to kind of the way I, you know, was raised, right? By, you know, with my grandmother being a very prominent member in the family, and she herself, you know, went to undergrad in her 60s and then got her master's in her late 60s and
wow,
did amazing things. And I never really thought about a woman not being able to achieve even more in many cases than the men in my family, you know. So I didn't really grow up with this kind of feminist or even this limitation mindset of, you know, you have to limit yourself. What I do think, and my cousin and I always talk about this because, you know, we both grew up very closely under her, is that she was tougher on us. Like, so we had a lot of, you know, my cousin especially had three brothers, and they used to just get away with murder. They were on the couch watching TV. We were the ones cooking, cleaning, doing everything. And we used to be like, this is not fair. And we used to say that to her, and she would like, that was like, not something, something was not fair is like, was like a trigger for her. She'd be like, stop complaining and get on with it, you know, kind of thing. And so I think in hindsight, she did that to make us tougher and make us realize that life is going to be hard. You're always going to have people telling you, you know, whatever, or that you're going to have to do far more than anyone else. But that's just the way it is, and get on with it. And, you know, I do think that that mindset helped me navigate, you know, all the challenges. Probably that if I had thought about it, I might have limited myself or felt inferior or felt like I can't do that because whatever. So anyway, that was just, you know, that's again my story and kind of more just the reality. Like, it, you know, it wasn't an option, you know. So
And that's a great mentality to have. And tell me, how did that factor into your first CEO position?
Well, lucky for me, I had a lifelong career prior to taking on the CEO role at Aviato. And I feel like every single experience that I had really, you know, set a very strong foundation and helped me ladder up to taking, you know, my first CEO role 4 years ago at Aviato. And so I think, you know, all the experiences that we all have, our personal as well as our professional journey, really sets us up well. Like, you know, even when things go poorly or you take twists and turns, as I say, not everything is linear. Every experience, you know, builds and helps you get to the next one. All the, you know, as we know, we learn much more from failure or things that don't go exactly as we had hoped than when everything is just glorious. And so I would say that I, you know, worked my whole life, both on the personal as well as the professional side, to get to this point.
How did you come across that opportunity? Tell me the story of how you became a CEO. You left, I mean, you were with Novartis for a very long time. It's nice and safe, I think, to have that career with a big company for so long. Why did you take the risk and the chance with a company on the other side of the pond?
Well, luckily at Novartis, I had a ton of global roles. So the pond part was, I lived in Switzerland twice prior and had managed teams all over the world. So I had a tremendous amount of exposure to the global aspects of the business, and certainly taking on a company based in the UK was just a continuation of that. I always say I grew up in New York, and unfortunately, as an American, you think New York is the United States and you think United States is the world. And I'm very fortunate that early on, you know, back to 2007, I had the opportunity to go live in Switzerland with my family and be exposed to the big world that is out there. And so that has, again, back to the experiences and the foundations we have and how that sets us up for future. In my last couple of roles at Novartis, to your question, I was leading our US and then our global neuroscience business. My team had done an acquisition of a company called AveXis, which is a CNS gene therapy company. And it was an amazing opportunity where, after had led the acquisition and the integration with an amazing team, went over to lead the worldwide commercialization of the acquired portfolio, which mainly in the short term was a product called Zolgensma, which was for children actually under the age of two who had spinal muscular atrophy, a very rare genetic but fatal disease. And having that experience over those couple of years and seeing the impact that a gene therapy can have, not only on an individual patient, but a community and society at large, was truly, you know, transformational for me personally, but for the space and the scientific innovation that could be possible. And, you know, after I did that role again with an amazing team all around the world, and we brought Zolgensma, by the time I left, at least to, you know, 41 countries and over 2,500 children, I thought, wow, what else could be so inspiring? And I started, you know, thinking about how I could take that experience and bring it out externally and contribute in a much bigger and better way as I went forward. I always wanted to go into the biotech startup world. As you say, after a while in one company over 25 years, it becomes very safe. And I had the wonderful opportunity of the breath of every year and a half or 2 years of the carrot dangling and some other opportunity that you can get experience in. But it was more of a when, and I just felt like the time was right for me. And I met Professor Chris Shaw, who's one of the main scientific founders at Aviato, and had a chance to listen to the work that he was doing. And it was truly disruptive, scary, as you say. There's big risk, both financially as well as, you know, science will be science. But it was enough. It just pulled at my heart, and it was enough of a draw to say, okay, now's the time. It's now or never. And I jumped in.
Lovely. And on your leadership journey, as it were, you've mentioned quite a few people who helped, I guess, inspire you along that way, or just create that natural environment of leadership for you. But were there any challenges or obstacles that stick out that you had to overcome?
A ton. There are always a ton of obstacles. I would be lying if I said it was easy. And also it wouldn't be as rewarding if it was easy, right? Or as tremendous of an experience and learning experience, mostly, if it was easy. I mean, there was so many twists and turns, again, as I like to say. You know, I think when you're younger, you think of your career very linear, right? You know, you're going to do this and then you're going to get that and that's going to lead to this. And none of that happens, right? I mean, or it, you know, in my opinion now, it shouldn't happen. You should take lots of, you know, side moves and try different things. And really put yourself in uncomfortable situations that may not be for everybody. But for me, I'm glad that, you know, is how my career went, because I do feel like it just gave me such a breath as well as depth of an experience, which really has become a foundation to be able to look at things a different way and challenge myself and just ultimately, you know, come at even just solving a simple problem in a very different way than some, you know, who just had one set of experiences may be inclined to do. One of my most defining experiences I had, I would say early in my career, I was coming back from Switzerland and I was taking on a small franchise for a therapeutic area in immunology where, you know, it was an ultra, ultra, ultra rare disease. So one in a million, very little budget tied to this product, but it was the poster child for the way that at the time Novartis was changing the way they did drug development. So whereas it used to be these mass market GenMed type disease areas, and then you see if something could have a 50% effect, et cetera. This was now saying, okay, if we have this therapeutic and it could have a 90% effect, and then we can in a very small indication, but over time we can expand, let's just turn drug development completely on its head. And so this program that I went over, came back from Switzerland to lead, was very small as far as the market opportunity expectation. Again, one in a million, but it was very large as far as being a huge pivotal, you know, change for the organization and how they did drug development. And, you know, to make a long story short, we ended up, you know, it was me and one other person. We had like $2 million. We launched the product from new products, which is unheard of. And you had to really be, very resourceful, I would say, as far as how you could, you know, A, there was no roadmap and how you could resource this and do something with it. But it was a poster child for the organization on how we were going to change the way we did drug development. So I guess my answer to the question would be, take a step back and think about, you know, things don't always seem what they are, right? You know, when you look at something that your immediate reaction may be like, well, why should I do that? You know, take a step back and say, actually, what could that really be? And so I'm all about the possibility. Sometimes I exhaust my teams with what would need to be true to make that happen? Or, you know, or how can we think about this in an entirely different way? And I think often, you know, we don't always separate what we know versus what we think we know. And so really taking a step back all the time and saying, okay, what could this really be? And are there, and what would need to be true to achieve it, is something that's not innate in all of us. Our natural, you know, kind of the way we all think is our, you know, we think we know, our defense mechanisms go up and we, you know, go forward. And so I would say pause, take a moment, think about the possibility, and then think about what would need to be true to get to that. And I always use that example of that program as the pivotal moment for me, because if I had thought about it I said no at first, by the way, and I had somebody call me up and say, you want to rethink this. And it really changed and transformed the way I was thinking about the opportunity. And it taught me a very valuable lesson. And so I always share that story.
That's a wonderful story. In fact, we had Pedro Gomez from Orbem. I think he's actually in Texas at the moment. of all the coincidences, but he was talking to our founder group, NextGen, on strategy, and he touched on that point you've just raised. And I think he called it test your assumptions. Would you agree with that? Is that the lesson from from these experiences?
Yes, absolutely. And I think especially in science, right? All of us are working with extremely, you know, cerebral, talent, right? Everybody is extremely intelligent and brilliant and often, you know, believes that they know where they're headed. And you can say test your assumptions for sure, but then you're still trying to prove you're right. So I would almost take a step back and say, you know, think about what's possible, and separate what we think we know versus what we do know. And don't necessarily, you want to define the larger destination, absolutely, and the goal, but try not to be so absolute in the path that you think today can get you there. Because if you take a step back and think about, could there be a different way, or could this lead to something different? I think you will go at it in an entirely different way.
Yeah, that flexibility is, I think, essential for survival for a lot of companies. Yeah. And tell me, we do an awful lot of this peer-to-peer learning in LifeScience.org, and learning from each other is one of the biggest things. So I'd love to know, is there a lesson you've learned on your journey from possibly a colleague, maybe a peer, maybe from family or just life, that you could never have learned it through formal education?
Definitely. There's so many, but maybe, you know, the top two for me would be early on in my career, I had a wonderful leader who, I was very junior when she told me this. And I remember, you know, again, I have a business background, not a scientific background. And I was, it was a new product for the company. And I was sitting at my desk at the end of the day, and she comes in and she drops off this huge, you know, about 100-page document, and says, okay, you know, tonight I want you to review, you know, the regulatory submission for this drug. And I thought, why would I review the regulator? I'm not a regulator and I'm not the science person. I'm the commercial person. Why would I review the regulatory submission? And she said, because at the end of the day, you're going to have to commercialize this product. So you should think about what it says in here, because that's what's going to end up, you know, in the label, you know, in the actual prescribing information. The lesson behind that is that, you know, if you're invited to be at the table, you need to think much more about how you contribute, right? So everybody sometimes shows up to the table and is in their swim lane, right? I was the commercial person, there was the regulatory person next to me, et cetera. But the reality is, if you're invited to the table, you there's no swim lanes. When you leave the room and the table, you go back in your swim lanes and you execute as needed based on your subject matter expertise. But sometimes the most innovative ideas, or the things that people miss, again, because everybody's focused on what they know versus what they don't know, come from the person who's furthest from the discipline. And that was that was a lesson and an absolute value that I keep very close to me. And I really impose that on my team. And not everybody loves that, I will say, right? But it's something that if you can get to the point where you come to the table and you're open to listen to anyone that's there, and everyone that's there feels that responsibility and that weight, that regardless of their swim lane, they're there to ask questions, challenge, all for the ultimate goal to get us to a better place, that is extremely powerful. And I would say this: the second part of that, which is not mutually exclusive to that, is same leader. Again, early on, had the privilege to work with her, and she said, you know, this question of what would need to be true to achieve X. And I say that all the time, and I rightfully give her the credit. I stole it from her, but I, throughout my entire career, I always think that, because it takes the emotion out of it for people. It's less about how smart they are or not, or what they know or what they don't know. It's just asking it in a different way. And it kind of puts people on the offense versus the defense. And so those are two things, you know, through undergrad or business school, no one ever told me, right? It was more of on the job through an amazing leader who I learned so much from, that, you know, gave me some tools to use throughout my career.
Those are two amazing nuggets of wisdom. And definitely you can't learn that in a classroom at all. I'd love to know, though, because this concept of staying in your swim, or not staying, rather, in your swim lane, mm-hmm. how do you teach that? How do you cultivate that culture in your organization?
It's very difficult, and it depends, and it grows over time, right? Because people, depending on where you grow up in the world, and I don't mean geographically, I just mean exposure and companies, culture is how people are used to working. Academia is not like that, right? People are very structured. You're less comfortable or more comfortable with it, depending on where you come from. And so I always find that, you know, in a new sit, whether it's a new team in the same organization or a new organization or whatever it is, you have to almost, it's some, you know, you have to be really purposeful in the beginning at setting expectations, you know, opens. Around the point of, if you're here at the table, this is what I expect. Everybody's contributing. But you can see the tensions. I call it a positive tension, which is not necessarily a bad thing, in my opinion. Build up as people get in that environment, because all of a sudden, you know, the smartest person in the room is like, why is this person who doesn't know anything about what I'm doing challenging me, right? And you just, it's the expectation, in setting that expectation. But the real magic comes when people start to see the benefit from it. And I have so many examples. I mean, so many examples through my career where, you know, I came into a new role, had a new team come together, started, you know, saying some of these things, or others were now speaking up and challenging, you know, the lead person, and they were on the defense. And then, you know, once it shifted and people realized, actually, wow, I never thought that could happen. And then all of a sudden it became their idea, right? And then everyone was aligned to the same goal, and the pride 12 months later when people achieve something they never thought was possible is just magical. But it takes time, right? So the key thing is setting that expectation up front and then really making sure we live by it. And it becomes uncomfortable. There is a positive tension in the room. People don't always like it, depending on, again, where they grew up and where they come from. But when they see the value of it, it is truly magical.
I like that. I like the idea of positive tension as well. It's not a phrase I've heard. I think we should adopt it for everything. That is a nice, that's the growth space. I like it. Before we talk about Aviato in a lot more detail, I'd like to talk a little bit about European life science, because it's very easy. It's very easy to be negative, especially if you're in Europe. But given your perspective, you've worked with Novartis from the stateside perspective. You've worked in Switzerland, and now you're the CEO of a London-based biotech. What do you find particularly exciting or inspiring about European life science today?
Well, there's a ton that I find exciting and inspiring, but I do think it starts with the people. I believe everything in life, you know, the science will be the science, but the people will truly make the difference. And we have in the European life science community, and for sure this is true in the UK, there's just a tremendous amount of talent, right? The scientific mind, the, you know, the education, the science that comes out of Europe in general, and you know, especially even in the UK, is really stellar to what is available in the rest of the world. And the commitment to from the community, from the academic community, to be able to ultimately bring life-changing medicines to patients is so strong. I think what we need to evolve and infuse more of is the what needs to be true to get it there, or what could be possible. Because to your point, sometimes it's almost like a self-limiting thing that happens, where people start to get into the, well, that can't happen because, and I always say, you know, you could tell a story two ways, right? You could say, we can get here if we have X, Y, Z, or we can only get here because we don't have X, Y, Z. And I feel like a little bit in the European life science sector, it's the latter story. And we need to shift it to the first part of, you know, to the first story, because that will just unlock the way people think. That will just take off the, as you say, a bit the negative filter or the restrictive mind that, you know, there's going to be limitations. And you know, that's a bit disruptive, right, to what's innate maybe culturally into how people grew up. And so I think, you know, also the diversity. Of bringing in people from all over the world. My leadership team is not just, you know, UK based. I have New Zealand, I have Americans, I have Brits, I have, you know, I'm in the company overall. We have, you know, I forget, over 100 countries represented, you know, diversity wow. of ethnicity, diversity of experiences brings just tremendous amount of innovation and different ways to think about things. And I think that's really important.
I like your thought on the two different ways of telling a story. Do you think being an American being an American in Europe is an advantage?
Yeah. You should ask my team that question. They might, at times, I'm sure they roll their eyes or, you know, look at me with a cynicism of that'll never happen. I mean, I have many moments where people are like, that will never happen. I said, no, I didn't ask you if that would ever happen. I asked you what would need to be true to enable that to happen. That is a very different question. But it's never going to happen. We shouldn't waste our time on it. And I'm like, I understand that you don't think it's going to happen, but I'd like to really just entertain the crazy possibility that it could happen and understand what it would take to make it happen. And, you know, that I'm sure at times really frustrates my team. But it gives me tons of energy to ask those questions. And I do truly believe in my heart that if you set the bar here, you will get here. If you set the bar here, you have a more likelihood of getting here. And, you know, we owe this to patients, right? Back to where we started this conversation, mm-hmm. we are an industry where the patient's fate is in our hands. I met a mom of a DMD patient who, you know, addressed the whole audience, and her phrase was so powerful to me. You know, and she said, you know, my son Joseph will either be the first to live or the last to die in this disease area, and that weight is in your hands. And I just thought, oh my gosh, like that just was so inspiring to me. And I say that all the time internally. We're doing this for a reason. And so we have to really push ourselves. If it was easy, anyone could do it, right? They're relying on us to do it, which means we have to sometimes get out of our own way and think about things completely differently.
Oh, for sure. And that is a very powerful story you just shared. Given everything we've discussed up until now, then, I think now is the time to talk about what you're doing with Aviato. Tell me, what is the great unmet need you face, and why is now the time to tackle it?
Yes, thank you for the question. So Aviato Bio, as mentioned earlier, is a CNS gene therapy company, and we're very much focused, to your question, on solving some of the most complex challenges that exist today in neuroscience. Our mission is all about developing and translating groundbreaking science, coupling that with precision delivery, and ultimately turning that into life-changing medicines. And why is that important? So in neuroscience, it's extremely hard in these neurological conditions to cross the blood-brain barrier, right? Our body just naturally defends against anything crossing. And because of that, it's very hard to get anything into the brain and or spinal cord. And in neurological conditions, it's critical to find a way, right, to get that, you know, maximize biodistribution while minimizing any safety, anything going into the peripheral, safety, systemic, et cetera. And so at Aviato, we are very much focused on precision delivery and how do we best solve this key challenge. Our pipeline is made up of a combination of different novel approaches. Our lead program is in a disease area called FTD, frontal temporal dementia, in a genetic form. And we have a novel direct delivery approach. So we go direct into the brain, into parenchymal, specifically into the thalamus. We dose the first ever adult intrathalamically and the first ever in the neurodegenerative disease. And again, with the ultimate goal to maximize biodistribution, which we believe will translate into efficacy and minimize safety for patients. And then our pipeline is also looking at other precision delivery approaches with novel capsids or other ways, even not more non and less invasive ways to achieve the same thing. So these are big challenges. You know, I talk about them in a simple sentence, but they are not simple. And the whole team is really rallied about solving for this and figuring this out. And if we can figure this out, not only can we, you know, target rare disease across neurodegenerative diseases, but also go into much broader areas like Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, you know, big, big problems for society.
Imagining that everything goes to plan, big, positive, optimistic vision of the future, like the results come through and they're great. You get all the funding you need to do what you want and more. What impact do you hope to create? Like, what does the world look like when you're successful?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, for us, our North Star is the patients, right? It's all about how do we truly transform and potentially cure these disease areas, right? If we could really bring genetic medicines to the forefront and find a way not only to treat patients symptomatically and slow the progression, but actually get them early and eradicate the disease or the symptoms from ever happening. I mean, think about the impact that has not only on one patient, not only on their family, not only on the community, but on society at large. Like, it's tremendous. It's not going to be something that Aviato can do on its own, right? It's going to be something that is obviously collaborating across with a number of stakeholders, but as well as the industry at large as a sector can do. And if you think about the burden of health on our world today and the impact that these little wins can have and how they ladder up to truly transformational shift in care, it's significant. And, you know, it's a big goal, but it's one that we have a lot of passion around.
That's absolutely fantastic. Lisa, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. But I have one more question for you. This is your podcast. So with the last few minutes, is there anything we haven't discussed that you would love to discuss with your time?
Oh, thank you for the question. You know, I think for me personally, it's really just as your audience here is those like ourselves in the sector, is to really just, you know, not give up, right? It's hard out there. The macro environment is difficult at the moment. But the work we're doing is so important. And so how do we work together as a, you know, industry to make sure that we can all achieve our missions as companies have, but truly have an impact on society? I think from an Aviato perspective, we are doing such important work. I'm so proud of the teams that we have internally and how hard they work. And I would just like to say a big thank you to them because, you know, as I said at the beginning, science will be the science, but it's the people that make the difference. And it's hard. And so we need to be resilient. We need to be relentless. And we need to, most importantly, collaborate together to get there.
That is a wonderful sentiment to end on. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you.
Everybody knows that Europe is a global leader in generating translational science. We also have world-class leadership talent. To hear the stories, lessons, and experiences of our science leaders, listen to A Call to Lead at LifeScience.org, available on all good podcasting platforms.